A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Mind Your Loaf, a podcast about taking action on your mental health. It's me and my own this week, but Mara will be back soon. And it's an Irish mental health charity, turntome.ie, who besides helping us with this podcast, provide professional mental health support online. And it's free to everyone in Ireland. Yeah, welcome to an episode of Mind Your Loaf. Now, this week is a little bit different. We don't have Mara with us. She's not with us because she has other family engagements going on right now. So we will hopefully have her for the next episode. So this episode, we have a man by the name of Paul Murr. So first of all, hello, Paul Murr. Can you hear me in the COVID interview?
Hi, Jason. I can hear you loud and clear.
Listen, thanks for joining us. Now, obviously, what I'll do during this whole interview, Paul, it's quite loose. We'll just talk about what you do. And a lot of times the information I have is not right. And you go, I don't do that at all. What are you talking about? So you are, Paul, the director of psychiatry in Trinity College. Is that right?
No, I have to divide that straight away.
Already, there we go. Give us the title.
I could get in serious trouble if I said yes to that.
Okay, no, what is it then?
I'm not. I'm the course director of clinical training in psychotherapy, psychoanalytic psychotherapy, which is based in the Department of Psychiatry.
Oh, my God. Well, you see, I wasn't that far off, but I know you all need your titles.
Exactly, yeah. A few pay grades off as well, Jason.
Oh, yeah, true, yeah, true, yeah, absolutely. So you work from Trinity, but you do stuff in UCD as well and lecture all around?
I visit and lecture in UCD and different parts of Trinity as well and various third-level institutions, mainly teaching psychoanalysis and neuroscience.
Right, okay, so what, I mean, basically how this this podcast works, Paul, is that I was thinking about going back to university, but I thought I haven't got time, so I bring people like you in and I just ask you loads of questions. So first off, what is neuroscience, Paul? What is that?
Neuroscience is one of the sciences that focuses mainly on the nervous system, which involves mainly the brain, but also we have a peripheral nervous system and a central nervous system. So it's really about how information gets into our bodies from the outside world, and also about how information about our bodies, our visceral organs, and that is communicated to our brain. So we in neurosciences, and as neuroscience is a big family. And so you've got neurophysiology, neurochemistry, neuropsychology, and then various different subdisciplines within neuroscience, again, that focus on particular parts of the nervous system. So it's a very broad family. So the piece that I'm interested in most is the neuroanatomy, which is the different parts of the nervous system and the brain and how they link into subjective experience, how do they relate to our mind, our experience of ourselves?
Okay. And so No, I get it. I know you're going, okay, does he get it? Because, like, I hear neuroscience and all I ever heard of was, like, it's, okay, it's the brain. It's like how the brain's working with, like, all the neurons and the makeup of the brain and the brain cells and the... So, but the thing is, like, the thing about the brain is, what I'd love to know is, like, is can we control our brains in any way? Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, what I'm trying to say is... I know we control, like, our brains control us, you know, as in, like, it's, we want to pick up that phone, we go for it, we pick it up, we bring it back again. But is that us controlling that motion, or is that the brain controlling that motion?
It's a bit of both, not to give you a kind of a fudge of an answer.
No.
But I think the safest thing we can say is that we can control parts of our brain.
Okay.
So the way in which the brain is structured, and it might be helpful to maybe just talk about the evolution of the brain and the nervous system. Because that really links into the functionality of how the nervous system works. So I suppose our earliest experience of consciousness, if you say, goes back something like 525 million years ago, when we separated from the vertebrates. So all vertebrates have a tiny little structure called, and there's a few kind of names that that sound like Star Wars characters here, or Star Wars planets, but there's a tiny little structure at the base of our brainstem, and it's called the periaqueductal gray. And what that simply means is it's the piece of tissue that goes around an area of water, which is our spinal canal. Okay, so it's the lowest part within the brain, in the brainstem, where consciousness exists. So if you were to have a lesion, if it was to get damaged, it's lights out, consciousness is gone.
All right. So if you cut that, you're not dead, but you'd be unconscious.
You'd be unconscious, yeah. And you would die pretty soon after that, because that part of the brain helps to regulate all your autonomic organs. Processes like breathing and knee detection and all of that kind of stuff. So at that point, we have a very basic fundamental experience of a good feeling and a bad feeling. So it has a front aspect to it, and it has a posterior aspect to it. If you stimulate the back part of it, the person experiences the most dreadful feelings of horror, of fear, of pain. And if you stimulate the front part of it, a person has the most exquisite pleasurable feelings ever, or orgasmic feelings.
How is it actually being stimulated? How are we actually operating that?
Because we're not operating it. It's very passive. It's very much a passive system. So it's kind of sitting around the spinal cord, and it's receiving inputs, information from the external environment. So all the data from the external environment, all our senses are channeled through the spinal cord. And all the information through our cranial nerves, and they all come up through the spinal cord, and there's data detecting sensors that hive information off of that.
So are you saying that it doesn't come through the eyes into the brain? Because people would have thought that it's all coming through the eyes into the brain.
Yeah, no, it comes through the eyes initially, but then the optic nerve travels down in a really kind of circuitous way into the spinal cord. That's one path. It branches off, though, into the back of your brain, into what they call the primary visual cortex. So you've got an old pathway that goes down into your spinal cord, and information is received there. It's the same for all of your senses, with the exception of smell. Smell is hardwired directly into your limbic system, which is a part of the brain that deals mainly with emotion. So that's really
I've looked it up. I tried to see what you did. I had no idea that it was like, I literally have no idea that this is what happened. Like, this is fascinating. And because a lot of people believe, like, you know, we control our emotions. Like a lot of people will say, well, if you're feeling down, that's because you're making yourself feel like that. Mm. Or if you're feeling happy, that's because you're making yourself feel like that, which kind of blends in what you're saying. Is what you're seeing or smelling or hearing. But let's say I smell something I don't like. I can't really go, I like that.
No.
Can I?
No.
But can I control my moods, though? with my...
You can learn how to control them.
Yeah.
Initially, when we are when we're born, okay. So maybe I'll just go back a little bit. When you ask me about vision and eyesight, so there's a part of that pathway, if you like, that branches off and goes directly into the cortex at the back of your head, where all your visual data is processed. And there's this other branch that goes down into the brainstem and the spinal cord. It's the same for hearing, for touch, for taste. All those senses travel the same way, and they all have pathways that go into the cortex and pathways that go down into the lower brain, the subcortical areas.
Yeah. Okay.
When we're born, the subcortical areas develop first, so they're front loaded, as it were. So all these areas that receive the information, they don't generate images. They don't generate conscious images. Okay. So you need your cortex to generate a conscious image, a mental image of something. So your visual image is an internalized representation of the external world. It's not actually how the external world looks. It's only a representation of the external world rendered through our senses. Okay, so our senses turn it into an image that we can see. It's the same with sound. It's the same with touch. So all objects in the external world that we can see are representations of that. They're in images.
Oh my God. That. So they're like, it's almost, it's like data going into your head.
Yeah.
And then it just goes, well, this is what we think it looks like.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, that's actually terrifying.
There's a big debate in philosophy around that.
But yeah.
We kind of know that that's the case from neuropsychology. So if you have a part of that, of the cortex knocked out, it relates to a particular type of image, whether it's like horizontal lines or vertical lines, you can no longer see horizontal or vertical aspects of imagery, or you can have half of your visual field knocked out of the cortex. The opposite cortex is damaged. So we know that there's a way in which our mental image that we generate is represented in the cortex, is represented by the cortex.
And so, as we were saying earlier on, which is the same, we're still on the same topic here, was that are we able to change the way we think? You know, because a lot of people who'd be listening to this, because this is like a, you know, mind your loaf, mental. It's all about mental health and well being. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people listening in, including myself, would go to therapy, and some people believe that therapy can change the way you think, because it's actually changing your thought patterns up there. So like, let's say like my dad, like, okay, so he passed away about 4 months ago. He's a great fella, but it looked like no matter how much therapy we ever did for my dad, he was always going to be doing the same thing, wanting the same thing, moaning about the same stuff. And my dad used to say, there's no therapy that could ever change me. You must be joking. I'm an old dog. So is that like a myth? An old dog, new tricks. Like can, so what I felt that when I went to therapy, I don't know if it was if it's actually happening to me, or is it just because I went to therapy and my brain is going, this is the way we should be thinking now. Like, is it a clinical thing? Almost like Paul is. So I've always wanted to know, is clinical depression a real thing, or is it just something that we make ourselves feel?
It's a very real thing. Now there are debates between, say, maybe psychotherapy, psychiatry, different branches of medicine, and how they understand that and how they label it. But there's no doubt about the fact that if somebody is clinically depressed and feeling depressed, that's a very real thing.
But what is clinical depression, though?
It's a paralyzing sense of sadness, is probably the best way to put it.
Okay.
And it can be grief. It can be as a result of anger. But really the best way to put it is like an extreme sense of sadness.
But can you be born like that? Is it...
You can. We have kind of individual set points and tendencies towards certain kinds of temperaments, certain kinds of moods. So you can have a pre-tendency, if you like, to be more sad or more happy. So we all have kind of biological set points around happiness and sadness. But clinical depression is a different thing. It's not just being sad. It's something that is paralyzing to people and shuts them down, and it affects their motivational systems, which is a very important part of the whole neurobiology of the brain and the mind.
So there's something physically happening in their brain when that's happening.
Yeah.
So it's not like, because there is people in the past that have, like this William Glaser fellow, he was into choice theory, like that stuff. Mm-hmm. He was saying sometimes he believed that people were choosing to be like that. So he was saying, for example, if you went for a run and while you were running and while you're actually running, he was asking his clients, are you actually depressed when you're physically running? And they went, well, no, they didn't think they were. Mm-hmm. And then he went, well, then when you're not running, you could be choosing to be depressed. But for me, and then there's some, it's great to talk to somebody like you, because a lot of people listening in will think, like, do I have mild depression, clinical depression, what is it? But it's great to hear that you're saying that clinical depression is a very real thing.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, it's tricky to get into the whole kind of the diagnostic categories around this. When I work with people, if someone comes into me and they have these symptoms, they're presenting with, you know, extreme sadness, you know, uncontrollable crying, they're paralyzed, they feel so bad that they can't get out of the bed in the morning, things like that. We start to work on like a history of their life, and you try to figure out the way I work. And the way a lot of psychoanalytic people work, it's really on the premises that there's a trauma of some kind that has in some way not been resolved. That can be relative, you know, across different people. And in some way, in kind of addressing that trauma and trying to, understand it a lot better, it can help people to move more out of that depressive state. So There's a couple of things that happen. And this, just to link back into that, the whole idea of running. And what Glaser doesn't really get at is the idea of how your physiology changes when you run. Okay. Your chemistry changes, your biology changes, different systems in your.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Brain get activated when you run, when you're active. There's a hormone that's generated when you're active when you run, particularly if you exercise for more than 20 minutes with an elevated heartbeat. You generate a hormone called BDNF, which is brain derived neurotrophic factor. And what that's like is like.
Is that like endorphins? Is that basically endorphins?
It's a hormone. And it's kind of like endorphins, but it's more specific in terms of it targets a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is involved in memory and learning. And it's like fertilizer for the brain. Now, what that does, the hippocampus is like a gateway into your thinking mind. Okay, so it allows the thinking part of your mind to work more efficiently. Okay, so if you exercise regularly, you improve your chances of learning through the system. Now, cortisol, which is another type of hormone, which is related to stress, when there's a lot of stress released and persistent and chronic stress in the system, it has the opposite effect to this BDNF and has the opposite effect in the hippocampus, and it shuts down the hippocampus, which is the part of the mind, which is the gateway to the part of the mind that can think and that can,
oh my God,
that can problem solve and strategize and reflect. And this is very often what can happen in people with severe depressive episodes. They're shut down.
Well, what happened to me, just to see if you can just say, so recently, yeah. My dad passed away. Now I'd be quite a positive fella. I'd always trying to do stuff. Then the COVID kicked in and as a comedian, whatever, I lost all my work, like all my gigs are gone. I'm not going to have another one probably till January. But what I'm trying to say is that I was fighting my brain almost. My brain wanted to shut down. It actually was going, I'm shutting down here. I can't take any more bad news or stress. But mm-hmm. some people, I thought, my brain really wanted me to get into bed and just go, do you know what we'll do here? Because I often hear that phrase, your brain doesn't do what's best. It does what's easiest. So I want to just get into bed. But so right now I'm doing this podcast and trying to get other stuff, but I'm actually fighting. But I don't know what I'm fighting, Paul. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I can feel this kind of almost cloud trying to come over me and push me down all the time because I'm getting constant like bad news, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so it's probably what's chemically is, it must be chemically happening inside me. Is that what's going on?
Well, first of all, Jason, I'm very sorry to hear about your dad and, and it's a very, that in itself is a very difficult time for people. So what you've just described are layers of trauma, if you like. Mm. So grief, bereavement is a massive trauma. COVID is a massive trauma on a scale that we've never experienced. No. Losing your work, your income, your way of life is also a massive trauma. They're pillars. They're all kind of pillars of your life that have just been pulled out from underneath you. Okay, so in our line of work, we would refer to that as like cumulative trauma. So it's one trauma after another. And they're not, by the way, insignificant traumas. They're major traumas. Okay?
Yeah.
So the way in which the brain and the nervous system works and the mind is that it's constantly trying to predict the environment. It's constantly trying to keep us safe. And we go back to this idea of these maps that we've generated. We have maps in our minds, and there's a neural correlate for these maps that really kind of map out an environment. They map out our relationship to an environment. We automize those maps in a way, so they just become part of who we are and part of how we live our lives. You pull one of those maps out of there, or you put in something, a major anomaly in relation to those things, something massive that changes around any of those things. Your system goes into kind of a stress response straight away to try to figure out, okay, what's new here? What's different? What's changed? To try to bring about some kind of certainty. Now, there's only so much in a cognitive sense that we can actually process. We're quite limited in what we can process. So if you have one trauma after another, and particularly the way they're layered, your response might be, and it can be different for other people, might be actually, well, let's just stick the head down here and try and recover.
Yeah, you know? I mean, a lot of people, because a lot of people listening in will be going through that right now, because they will have lost their jobs and they're all just going, oh my God, I don't know what to do. But can therapy change that? Like, I haven't actually been able to go to therapy because of the COVID, but can it actually fix me? Do you know what I mean? Or fix people who are in that like horrible depression state? Because a lot of time people think, a lot of doctors will prescribe drugs as a kind of a quick fix. But that's grand. I'm not like, I always hear that like a drug. I don't put down drugs. I just think whatever's needed to be done.
No, like, me neither. Yeah.
It's up to whatever has to happen.
Yeah.
But is therapy like the one number one type of fixture you need to go to? Or is it exercise? Or is it vitamins? Or is it your diet? Or, like, which is...
Okay. Well, what we do know from outcome studies that there are several factors that contribute to successful outcomes in therapy. And again, it's back to this. Therapy is a kind of a form of learning, if you like. So it's about optimizing your opportunity to learn. So eating clean, trying to avoid processed foods is one thing. Exercise, yes, 20 minutes a day or more, if you can. And it doesn't have to be, I mean, it can be brisk walking or
walk the dog,
or whatever. Yoga or meditation. Okay, so those three things bring about the best outcomes in therapy, plus the person's capacity to engage in the therapy and their willingness to be open to work. Yeah, to work in the therapy. Those are the big factors. And if you have that, and people can do that to varying extents, you know, but if you have those four things there, your outcomes, the research suggests, your outcomes are likely to be very good.
What's the four things again, Paul?
Diet.
Yeah.
Okay, so, eating clean, as it were. Mm-hmm. And that's no particular kind of diet, just trying to avoid processed foods. Mm-hmm. The exercise, so 20 minutes or more a day.
Whatever.
Again, that feeds into this piece about the BDNF that I talked about, increasing the part of your brain that's linked to learning. And yoga or meditation. Okay, so they help to dampen down your nervous system and your stress response. So all the time what you're doing is there's another structure in the brain called the amygdala, okay, which is responsible for emotional learning, really, but primarily fear and stress. So all of those things that I've just mentioned dampen down the amygdala, and they in some way kind of waken up the hippocampus or open up the hippocampus. So you're kind of regulating those systems that give you the best opportunity to learn, to regulate yourself, to calm yourself down, and therefore then to think, to get your thinking mind back online. And then it's about the fourth thing is your capacity to engage or your willingness to engage. And I'm just a little bit careful about using that language because some people can't, and it's not about willingness, and it's not about not working hard enough. But again, that ties into the fit between the person and the therapist, you know? So that's really important.
Now listen, I probably got to about four therapists before I really clicked. And then I just all of a sudden went, they're totally on my wavelength. Now I get it. Now I know what I have to do.
Yes.
But I was very confused before that. And I'd be a very open-minded dude, but I just couldn't really connect with them. They were trying to tell me, and I was going, I don't really get what that means. Yeah. And then, it was brilliant. I went into a great therapist, and the first thing she did, she had to listen to me, and then she sat me down, and her first words were, "Who the fuck do you think you are?"
you knew where you stood then straight away.
Yes, I went, "All right, okay, I found my therapist. She's brilliant." But here I found this. Was asked to ask you, what is epigenetics? Is that how you say that?
Epigenetics. Okay. Epigenetics is a relatively new discovery within the neurosciences, and it used to be thought that we were a product of our genes. So it goes back to this old kind of question in psychology and biology, which is the most kind of is it nature or nurture?
Okay,
is it our genes or is it our environment? So with the discovery of epigenetics, it opens up this possibility, but we now understand that it's a mixture of both. So it's how our genes interact with our environment, and our environment can turn on and turn off certain genes.
Well,
okay. So, yeah.
Okay.
So the classic example of that is the gene for type 2 diabetes. Okay, you might have the gene for type 2 diabetes, but you might never meet the environmental circumstances that would turn it on. Okay, so you could be a very, very active, very healthy person, that will, you won't meet the environmental factors that will kick in the type 2 phenotypes, which is the metabolic syndrome and all of that. So there are some genes that are kind of immutable, like your hair color and your eye right. button, and they're, oh, not, shit. They're not affected by it. I know, you're only saying, you know, you can't tell, but I'm a ginger too. you know, I suppose there are factors then that turn on and turn off genes around resilience and stress response. And they influence what we call the protein expression of circuits and neural tissue. So you can have an environment that's very stressful, and it can, over a period of time, it can affect the genetic expression of certain characteristics in people. Okay, so it can. So if a child, they've done some really interesting research in Canada around this, where they've looked at kids that come from lower socioeconomic groups, and they've monitored them in kindergarten, as they call it over there, and they've tracked their stress responses, and they've had a very interesting way. They've taken samples of their teeth, their first tooth when it falls out. Instead of giving it to the tooth fairy, the psychologist takes it, brings it off, and measures it. So your tooth enamel is an expression of how much cortisol is circulating in your system. And what they
all
found
your life,
was,
like yeah. all your life. Well, yeah. so Gary, yeah. go on. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
So what they discovered was that the kids that were from the lower socioeconomic groups had the most amount of cortisol circulating in their systems, and that ended up having there's a lifelong study, you know, and they tracked these kids across their lifespan, and those kids ended up having more heart disease, being involved in more crime, more arthritis, cancer, less successful in relationships, less successful financially, and there's a very strong correlation.
But is that so that's an actual makeup that got nothing to do with their society, like when they're growing up. I mean, if they're taken out of that society and they manage to get out of there, are they still going to have those traits?
Yes, they'll still have those traits, but if they meet a good enough environment, it can help to alter those traits.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's like...
So the
brain can constantly change.
Yeah, there's two aspects. So remember I talked about the cortex.
Yeah.
Which is it's the most recently evolved part of our brain. And then there's the subcortical areas that are, in evolutionary terms, much older. They're harder to change. They're quite fixed. And so we have kind of behaviors and traits that are inherited across evolution. So like your emotions, for example, like anger, fear, we don't learn how to be angry, and we don't learn how to be frightened, and we don't learn how to hate or to lust. You know, they're automatically built into our systems. But we do learn what to be angry at, or what to be afraid of. And that's more cortical. So the cortical part of our brains are more plastic and more receptive to the environment. And they can change.
Oh my God, that was amazing. The great Paul Moore. Oh, I tell you, I don't know. Look, we have had to edit this podcast down majorly. Like, we could have listened to him for hours on end. I had, like, most of the stuff that he said, I had no idea were actual things. Like, you know, that we actually have to meditate, do yoga, and do exercise, and do, but only bits of stuff. We don't have to go too mad. So that was Paul Moore. I just think there might be a session two for that. But God, thank you, Paul Moore, for coming on Mind Your Loaf. So you've been listening to, well, me, Jason Byrne. There's no Mar this week, but you'll be back soon. And this has been Mind Your Loaf. If you like this episode, please subscribe and tell your friends. And don't forget, if you or somebody you know is going through a tough time, there is professional mental health support online, from counselling to support groups, all available for free to anyone from Ireland at turntome.ie. Thanks for listening, everybody, and mind your loaves, especially your brain, which is your loaf.
Turn to Me provides professional mental health support.
Jason, do your, your ad voice.
Oh, yeah, I'll do the ad. Yeah. Okay, I'll do a proper ad thing. Okay, ready? Yeah. As a registered charity, Turn to Me provides professional mental health support online for anyone in Ireland going through a tough time. From one-to-one counselling to group and peer support, Turn to Me is accessible from any device anywhere in Ireland. If you would like to support Turn to Me, you can donate €4 by texting Turn to Me to 50300. Text costs €4. Turn to Me will receive a minimum of €3.60 service provider like charity. Helpline 076-680-5278.
Is that you?
Yeah, that was actually me. Okay. There. I was gonna...
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.